The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 07-2021, State of Ohio versus Lamont Hunter. Mr. Freeman.
May it please the court, counsel for the State of Ohio. Your Honors, we are asking leave of court to bifurcate our arguments so that Mr. Hust may produce the second half of the arguments. I'm going to talk about the first three assignments of error, and then I would ask the court's indulgence in letting him present the remaining assignments of error in the appellant brief. We would also like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, the first three assignments of error basically deal with defendant's appellant right to effective assistance of counsel in a capital case. We are alleging in specificity that Clyde Bennett, the attorney who did the trial, was not certified to represent capital defendants pursuant to Ohio Rule of Superintendents 20. Your Honor, we are very aware that any lawyer who is licensed in Ohio is capable of being retained by a client. We are not trying to say that that's not appropriate. What we are saying, however, is that Rule 20 not only creates the minimum standard of appointed counsel in Ohio, but it creates a floor, so to speak, of presumptive competence for attorneys across the board.
Is there anything in the rule that even hints that?
Judge, there's nothing specific that says exactly what I said, but I do think, given the totality of the circumstances and the case law, that it's reasonable to assume.
Am I wrong that Bennett's reputation as a criminal defense attorney was stellar at the time?
Certainly, Your Honor. And he's back in the saddle, and he's trying a case right today in Warren County that's a homicide non-capital case. Yeah. I want Mr. Bennett to succeed. I hope he's doing well. We're focusing on a particular period in his life.
And it's hard to overlook that that was going on, but tell us the exact timing of how the federal indictment, had he been indicted, was he aware of the charges at the time he was handling this matter?
Your Honor, Mr. Bennett basically replaced counsel for two appointed counsel certified under Rule 20 on the day the case was set to go to trial. 4 months later, he came back, tried the case himself without help, basically. It's noteworthy that when he asked for the continuance in the first place, he said that he learned that the mitigation specialist that the appointed lawyers had secured at state expense had resigned and taken a job in the private sector. He placed of record the fact that he was not only going to do the lawyering job himself, he was also going to do the mitigation specialist job.
Right, and he did call, what, seven family witnesses?
He did, Your Honor. He called seven family witnesses. Given what they had to volunteer, that was excellent work. But basically, there are certain things that I think need to be addressed.
Help us with what beyond the fact. I mean, we're well aware that if he was aware of his pending problems with the federal authorities,
that he that was, would, Your Honor,
that had to be an enormous distraction in his life.
Exactly, Justice Pfeiffer. Exactly.
What specifically? In this case, in what way did that evidence itself in substandard representation of your client?
Judge, basically, the specifics of the federal indictment I know some of this stuff is not in the record, but it focuses directly on your question, Justice Pfeiffer.
Well, we're aware of the federal indictment because we had to handle his discipline.
Yes, sir.
Case. And so
we would ask you to take judicial notice of the file that you have that the public is not, for public policy reasons, entitled to look at.
Whether we take judicial notice or not, we can hardly be unaware of it as we deliberate in this matter.
Exactly, sir. It was an indictment by information that he entered a guilty plea to.
No, my question is, what about that? What specific in the case of your client, what can you point to that was deficient in his representation of your client?
Number one, Your Honor, 4 months elapsed between the time that he first took over the case and designated with an entry that he was trial attorney replaced as successor counsel. The trial took place with just him, one lawyer. As I mentioned earlier, he also basically assumed on the record that he was going to be the mitigation specialist. This is a person who the court is aware coordinates witnesses, including a courtroom phase, making sure that the people that are either experts or civilians are there and available, summarizing what they have to say, making it easier for the lawyers, in this case, the only lawyer, to get organized, put their presentation together correctly.
But did your client have limitations of intellect or mental health problems that were overlooked and not presented to the
judge? There's nothing in the record indicating that he was of inferior intellect. Mr. Hunter is not a college graduate, but nevertheless, we are not disputing the fact that he had normal intelligence. Here's my point, though, and this goes directly to the next step. I appreciate your question. One of the things that Mr. Bennett did do, while this other matter was distracting him, to use your word, he waived the jury.
Right, and you argue in your brief that that is tantamount to malpractice.
Your Honor.
And I don't know that we've seen that argument before.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I think that a waiver, you can't waive something that you don't understand. I agree that a client can waive a jury, even in a capital case, but for that to happen, the client needs to execute what amounts to a conditional waiver. The form should have been 3 or 4 pages spelling out in particularity exactly what a capital case looks like and exactly what would be decided by a 3-judge panel as opposed to a jury.
Well, strategically, though, wouldn't you agree, given the facts and the evidence against your client, the idea of having a jury hear that horror story and presumably reaching the same verdict the judges did on the guilt phase, and then being able to dispassionately look at the question of death or not, I think to most of us it would seem problematic as opposed to having 3 judges be able to set that aside and look carefully at what the statute says in making the judgment of death or not.
Your Honor, I think a capital case especially requires reliability. This has always been a special concern of yours, why you have serious reservations about
right.
Many capital cases and how they come down, that the reliability just isn't there sufficient to ensure a good result. Had Mr. Bennett had a jury, he would have had 12 people. The court would be required as a matter of law to instruct that jury that any one of those 12 people had the capacity to block a verdict of death, and that the law basically is satisfied with a verdict of life imprisonment in any one of several fashions.
Mr. Freeman, let me take you back to where I think you were beginning when you talked about the fact that your client's counsel, Mr. Bennett, didn't meet the qualifications of Superintendent's Rule 20. Are you saying that retained counsel must be death penalty qualified in every case?
No, I am not, Your Honor.
Okay, I don't then understand what you're arguing to us with respect to that position.
What I am saying is that retained counsel just because you're retained. It gets you around the necessity of going to the seminars and doing all that it takes to become certified for Rule 20, but it does not mean that you're able to put together an inferior work product.
Well, that's the question Justice Pfeiffer was trying to ask you. What was it about the performance of Mr. Bennett? Did he fail to call a mitigation witness? Did he fail to present mitigation testimony? Did he not call fact witnesses? Or what was it about the lawyering that he offered in this trial that you find fell below the standard of Strickland versus Washington?
Your Honor, first of all, we would respectfully submit that in 4 months, one lawyer cannot do both the jobs of two lawyers as
You're
well as...
You're making it a temporal argument, and I'm asking you from the objective standpoint of what happened that we can read in the transcript should have happened differently such that the outcome of the trial would have been different, which is the standard we have to follow.
Yes, sir.
In applying this.
Yes, Your Honor.
You haven't said anything to us that meets that standard in my judgment. I'm asking you to tell us what your position is on that.
Your Honor, no rebuttal experts were presented as to the merits phase to rebut the state of Ohio's theory as to how the causation of death took place. We would respectfully submit that a rebuttal medical expert should have been brought in, forensic pathologist, to rebut the testimony of the physicians who were used.
Counsel, do you know that one existed?
Not with a mathematical certainty at the time, Your Honor. I certainly know that one's available now. We can't get into that. But other theories are out there. The habeas people have an affidavit on file from Werner Spitz, the godfather of forensic pathology, who basically comes up with a totally different theory, basically saying that the injuries to the child are totally consistent with a fall, with an accident. Now, I know that's not in the record at the time that you have a limited scope here,
right.
But I'm trying
okay,
as best
so
I can.
Let's move on to another example of what you would say would be some performance issues that would relegate it to a violation of the Strickland standard.
Okay.
So what I've heard basically from you is that choosing a three-judge panel over a jury is the mortal sin here. Is that right?
Your Honor, it's presumptively, in my mind, almost malpractice unless there's a very knowing and intelligent waiver, a specific conditional waiver. I'm asking you to just do the math. If you have 12 jurors, you have 12 different people, any one of whom can block.
And we're well aware of the capacity of 12 jurors and the need for unanimity in this type of a case. That's not at issue here. What you're telling us that based on the fact that there may have been one juror out of 12 that would not have voted for the death penalty, you say that is per se malpractice when you're selecting a three-judge panel.
I'm saying that there is a high probability, Your Honor, a much higher probability of finding one of 12 jurors than there is of finding one of three justices.
And would that be the rule of law that we should emanate from this case? That a defense attorney needs to do the math before they decide a trial strategy?
Judge, I think there is an algorithm that a lawyer has to go through when preparing a presentation, and the laws of probability and statistics are something that you take into consideration. Now, I can't sit down and with a crystal ball tell you that the result for sure would have been different with a jury, but I don't think that there was anything placed of record, especially given the fact that the waiver of a jury trial was not a conditional waiver, to give us any reason not to be very suspect of the fact that the jury was waived.
You keep talking about a conditional waiver. What do you mean by a conditional waiver?
Judge, it's possible to construe a written waiver to have more than one or two lines on it. The standard waiver, as this court knows, only has two or three lines, that the defendant, having been advised by the court that he has a constitutional right to a trial by jury, hereby waives or gives up that right. The lawyer signs it, the client signs it, the judge goes over it. We would respectfully submit that the proper procedure, if it's a capital case and if you're waiving a jury and going to a three-judge panel, We're saying that you can't waive what you don't understand.
So you want a very detailed written form with specific questions and answers that the defendant has to sign as a standard in a capital case? This is something new that you want?
I would say that there are some jurisdictions that have experimented with this kind of a form. Certainly, Your Honor, when a plea is taken in a criminal case, there's a 2 or 3 page plea form that explains various things that go on in there.
But doesn't the record reflect that your counsel said he talked this matter over at great length? This was not a last minute decision. His client clearly understood. Weren't these representations made to the court?
Your Honor, that was a very self-serving statement.
Are you saying the attorney
I know it's
was
on the record. I remember
the attorney was not telling the truth when he was making those assertions to the court?
I'm saying, given the totality of the circumstances, the attorney for the defendant appellant may not have even been focused well enough to realize that
That his client didn't really understand it? You're saying that he's telling the court his client understands it, but he doesn't really know if his client understands it? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that we don't know what exactly was going in the client's mind because there was no elongated discussion, a colloquy between the court and the client about the specificity of a waiver in a capital case. I think someone from the court at that point in time, from the three-judge panel, should have basically had a specific conversation, more than the conversation that is the typical waiver conversation. They should have talked about the specifics, that 12 jurors would be your other option, each one of which would have the power to block a verdict.
Don't we have case law that has said that that's not necessary, that the court has to go into that great detail?
Judge, I know that. I'm just going to the concept of reliability. For years, this has been Justice Pfeiffer's main concern. I think it's you're all on record of, as wanting as much certainty as you can before society takes the life of someone. And even though Mr. Bennett was not incompetent, he was a civilian. He was not more than a high school graduate. A standard waiver involves his lawyer, that at the time he thought was doing a good job, presenting to the court a 2 or 3 line document, reciting a self-serving statement, at which point the client nods his head and says, "Yes, Your Honor, that's what I want to do." The court approves it. That's fine, except...
What do you mean by a self-serving statement?
How do we, Your Honor, how do we know that Mr. Bennett actually did what he said he did, given the totality of the circumstances that we're learning in bits and pieces and that this court is well aware of, given the investigation that you did, not about matters later on, but about matters that were going on contemporaneous to when this case was being investigated.
Counsel, do we have an affidavit from the trial counsel saying that he was distracted and not rendering competent legal services to your client?
Mr. Bennett has refused to give an affidavit either to myself or the habeas lawyers, Your Honor. He's refused even to return a call to them. I understand what you're saying. I'm trying to say that we haven't...
In other cases, we have seen the trial counsel sign an affidavit with an admission of either unpreparedness or some deficiency in their performance to aid the appellate counsel before this court. And we don't have that here.
Judge, I met with the State Public Defender Habeas Capital Division last night. My partner and I did a dry run of a lot of the stuff we're talking about here. As of last night, they confirmed that as of last night, Mr. Bennett has still refused to return their calls in an attempt to secure an affidavit that would merely say that Mr. Bennett at the time was distracted.
So basically, you're speculating that he was distracted. You're saying, you know, he had these things going on in his personal life, and therefore he was rendering incompetent service.
And he had no help.
Well, okay, but there have been other cases where single attorneys have tried cases, and that's not a guidepost necessarily. That's in your idea, you know, in your mind, you'd like to make an argument to that, but there's no requirement that there be 2 or 3 attorneys. Is that true?
No, there's not, Your Honor. You're correct.
And you know, what I'm concerned with is you're saying that here, Mr. Bennett had some issues in his personal life that were going on. what attorney doesn't have issues in their personal life and their life outside of the courtroom that weigh on them on a daily basis, whether it's family issues or issues such as Mr. Bennett was confronting, health issues, et cetera. And now you're going to say that the court has to pay attention to what was going on in the life of the defense attorney?
Judge, there was no way of knowing this at the time, but we certainly know that there were matters going on now, looking back, based upon records that you're the custodians of. Judge, I have read about you and your background. I know a little bit about the background of every one of the seven justices here. My guess is that none of you, despite the fact that you've had health problems, family issues, work-related things in other cases, that none of you has been distracted to the point where you were facing federal time in the slammer. Mr. Bennett knew
but
or had to know that he was going—
You're speculating. You have to admit what you're saying here before this court is your personal opinion, your speculation.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I would, though, ask you to just consider one factor. Jim and Nancy Petro have an excellent book that came out recently, False Justice. There are eight myths in there, and I'm basically referring specifically to one of the myths that civilians sometimes have, and asking you to not make the same mistake unless you really are sure about what you're doing. Please do not assume that some other court is going to fix this. This court is in a unique position to have custody of all of these records. I know that the state and the federal habeas people have excellent lawyers. I know they do great work, but there's no guarantee they're going to get better records than are already available to you right now. We're not asking you to acquit Mr. Bennett today. We're asking you to reverse and remand for appropriate relief given unreliability criteria that are apparent given the totality of the circumstances.
Counsel, are there federal cases that you can refer us to that have articulated this concept that you want us to adopt?
I don't have a laundry list of federal cases in my mind, Your Honor.
Okay. Counsel, before you yield the rest of your time to your colleague, on page 15 of your brief, you allude to or say, you total up the amount of money that he was suspected to be laundering, $124,000. You say Bennett was desperate for cash and not inclined to tell defendant appellant's family he was distracted by his own issues. I assume you've been able to learn from your client how much time Bennett spent with him. I think there's an implication, at least, that he took this case just for the money. Do you know how much your client's family was able to pay him?
$8,000, Your Honor.
And what was there a feeling on the part of the family and your client that he didn't visit with your client at length and discuss the case? First of all, discuss the underlying criminal charge.
Judge, some of his family are here this morning in the audience. His family, I have worked extensively with his family, is how we subdivided the work in my office, not only with his family spokesperson, but also with individuals. They don't know whether to put their angry hat on or their cry bitter tears hat on. Had they known what was going on, they would have stuck with the appointed lawyers.
Yes, I understand that, but one, even I've had to hire a lawyer from time to time and have a sense of when the meter's running faster than it ought to be for the work that's being done. I think any person gets a sense of that. So what was the sense that you got from your client as to whether or not Bennett actually did the work, because I'm getting out of your brief the implication he just grabbed the money and showed up in court.
How do we know that's not exactly what happened, Your Honor? So there's a general rule, Occam's razor, that says that your first impression is usually the correct answer.
You create that impression in your brief, but I'm asking you, did your client have that impression at the time.
He does now, sir.
He doesn't. I'm asking at the time.
No, sir.
All right.
At the time this took place, he thought he was getting, he bought into the general jailhouse myth that anybody that's willing to work for the public defender's office, either on salary or as a freelance person like myself and Mr. Hust, must not be able to walk and chew gum at the same time, or that they don't give a rat's you know what about their client. It's the unfortunate part. I love America, but in this country, royalty consists of people with money. In the real world, that doesn't mean that they're actually successful in a personal integrity standpoint, but there are an awful lot of people that market themselves as better lawyers, and they charge big money for what they're doing. And I have nothing against making money. This is America. We have a capitalist society. I agree with that. But it should be done with an open disclosure. It shouldn't be done over the bodies that you've stabbed in the back of other lawyers. It's fine if Mr. Bennett got hired. We would respectfully submit that there's a decent chance that since every dime of Mr. Bennett's money was tied up because the feds, what happened was Mr. Bennett didn't have, he was smart enough to know that you have to make deposits of cash in amounts less than $10,000 or they get reported.
Right, counsel, you're straying from what
yes,
is relevant
ma'am.
Here. The question I have is that it appears that Mr. Bennett put substantial effort into the mitigation phase here in the preparation of witnesses that would humanize this defendant, your client. Is that true?
He did. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
He put seven witnesses on. They were all decent witnesses. And
they were all prepared. They all had a story to tell about the defendant. They all reflected the defendant in the light most favorable to the defendant for the consideration of the court.
They did, Your Honor.
And they all had firsthand information to share, knowledge of the defendant from their personal interaction.
They did, Your Honor. We would respectfully submit that he should have added an expert witness, maybe two expert witnesses, at mitigation, one of whom to say that the jury go with life without parole as an option, that life without parole means life without parole. Most jurors think that a life sentence means about 15 years, at which point they're out to reoffend.
Again, that's speculation on your part.
I know. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. You've got about 3.5 minutes saved for your co-counsel.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, you all.
May it please the court, Your Honors, I'll try to be as concise as possible under the circumstances. Again, may it please the court, Mr. Springman, Mr. Freeman. Your Honors, I would like to talk briefly about propositions 4 and 8 and 9 and would submit on the rest. Your Honor's proposition of law number 4 involves evidence rule 404B involving prior acts of Lamont Hunter, which were brought in. These involved very similar incidences involving the victim, Trust in Blue. They happened in January and June of 2004. We would maintain that this was an unfair bootstrapping of the case. The injuries were consistent, we might add, with what Hunter said had happened, and they couldn't even show that he did this. There was no indication that these prior incidences were anything that he did. As a matter of fact, Hamilton County Jobs and Family Services did not bother to open a file on these, and the mother even had concerns that she herself might hurt the child. I think that's some indication that she herself may have been involved in that. We realize under the Conway standard that there is an abuse of discretion, but—
Was this in the guilt or the penalty phase?
In the guilt phase, Justice Fiver.
And, all right.
And we would maintain that there's meritorious argument there that we need to make under Poindexter, and it's all the more prejudicial in light of the arguments that Mr. Freeman made. And also when we look at the totality of the circumstances. Your Honors, under proposition of law number 8, we would maintain that there was insufficient evidence that the trier of fact could not have found Lamont Hunter guilty of any or all of these crimes beyond a reasonable doubt. If we look at the totality of it, Lamont Hunter was the one who called 911. He gave the little child CPR. He waved the emergency personnel into the house. The fireman saw no visible injuries. He made no incriminating statements. He even voluntarily spoke to the police. The officer, Officer Knoll, who did the investigation, didn't bother to talk to any family members about any incidences very close to this time to try to rule out any other things that may have happened.
No Counsel, blood. Did I misunderstand the fact? You said he called 911. I thought he called the mother, and she came home and she called 911.
I was thinking, Justice Pfeiffer, thinking back, that he himself did. In any event, he did call the mother, yes. In any event, he did report this to try to aid the child as quickly as possible. Not the sort of thing a guilty person would do. As far as the basement steps in the house, Your Honors, no evidence was found on those steps, no blood or body fluid on those steps. The steps were 11 feet 2 inches long. The second step from which the child fell, Mr. Hunter maintained, is 1 foot 6.5 inches, certainly a big enough drop for a little child like that to hit his head and subsequently be seriously hurt and die.
You haven't addressed the evidence of the sexual molestation.
Your Honor, on that, if I may, that's true. I haven't gotten to that yet. One thing that Dr. Makaroff, who is the pediatrician from Children's Hospital who testified about the injuries, she said that a fall down the stairs could cause bleeding from a pre-existing injury. So it's quite possible that what they alleged was the anal tear that came from a rape was something that pre-existed and it was bleeding at that time because the child fell down the steps.
Although the mother did not hear the child complain of any pain that morning, and it was examination later on that said this would have been an extremely painful situation for the child.
Yes.
We're talking a three-year-old here.
Right. Around 9 o'clock that morning, an aunt, Wilma Forte, spoke to the child. The child was okay then. However, it's quite possible that the child could have been injured sometime before and the wound got well enough to where it wasn't bothering the child significantly, but when the child accidentally fell down the steps, certainly we would maintain something not shown to be done by Lamont Hunter, that could have caused this pre-existing wound to open up. Dr. Stevens, Gretel Stevens, the deputy Hamilton County coroner, did not know how the child died. She said he could have fallen down the steps, and she admitted that head injuries do predominate falls down the steps. Your Honors, we would maintain if this was a wrongful death civil suit where the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence, it would be one thing, but obviously this is a criminal case where the standard of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt, and we believe that was not met here.
Thank you.
And do I still have some time, Chief Justice?
No, you don't.
Okay. Thank you very much. We would respectfully request at least a reversal and remand. Thank you very much.
Mr. Springman?
May it please the court, counsel for Mr. Hunter. First of all, regarding Mr. Bennett, when we look at the record, Mr. Bennett provided a pretty outstanding defense. We have to keep in mind that the state did have significant evidence against Mr. Hunter in this matter. And most of that evidence consisted of some medical testimony from Dr. Makaroff and the coroner, Dr. Greta Stevens.
Counsel, did you try the case or are you appellate?
I did not try the case,
okay.
No.
If you know, and you may not be able to know, it's probably difficult from your perspective to know, on the guilt phase, whether or not Mr. Bennett at least surveyed the possibility of expert testimony disputing the conclusions of the folks who testified saying this couldn't have come from a fall down the stairs.
Right. I'm not in a position to know whether or not he did that.
So we just don't know.
Right. It's very possible that he explored that avenue.
Okay. Would you regard that as a fundamental first step in the representation of this defendant?
My guess is, knowing Mr. if I'm speculating,
yeah.
And my guess is I know Mr. Bennett, he did explore that area and it didn't get some very good results based upon the medical testimony. When you look at this medical, read this testimony, when you see it, it's some, Dr. Makroff is very damaging to Mr. Hunter's case because she testified that a pediatric ophthalmologist was able to view Trustin's eyes with an instrument and they found significant retinal hemorrhaging. And right from the beginning, she said that could never have occurred with a fall down the steps, that injury alone. Then when we move along and we get further along in the examination and we learn that Trustin died as a result of two distinct blunt impacts to the head, those injuries and the severity could not have occurred with a fall down the steps.
On opposite sides of his head.
Opposite sides of his head. And he had significant subdural bleeding, which he was bleeding through the layers of the brain. That could not have been caused from a fall down the steps.
And so what was their testimony? This is beyond shaken baby, isn't it?
It's beyond, yes. The retinal hemorrhaging could have occurred from a shake, but not the blunt impacts to the head. Now, there's some speculation in one report, and it's in a report, that perhaps he was swung like a baseball bat. But in the trial testimony, you know, he had damage done to his chest. There were puncture wounds in his chest, but there was also some bruising to the little boy's chest. So it's possible that he was slammed against some hard, flat surface twice, and it had to be significant. But what's even more significant is is the coroner's testimony about how cartilage was displaced from one of his neck bones. And there was the cervical displacement of one of those neck bones. So this had to be a tremendous amount of force. And in cross-examination, and Bennett, he really knows medicine, and he had to have practiced in this area. I think the prosecutor alluded to it in closing argument, but he had some extensive medical knowledge, and he was trying his best during cross-examination of Makroff and Stevens to claim that this might have been an accident. Could this have been an accidental fall down the steps, as his client claimed? But one of the things he had going against him was not only the two separate impacts to the head, but the coroner testified he would have almost had to have been thrown from the steps. It couldn't have been a fall from the steps.
Given all of that, that would address the decision to waive a jury.
Right.
Let me ask, though, counsel for the defendant has indicated that it is clear now that Bennett knew of his difficulties with the federal government at the time he took on this representation. He knew that he was at substantial risk.
Right.
Is that correct? Do you agree that what you now know about the
right.
timing of how his problems unfolded, that he was well aware of them? This wasn't something that was an investigation that was unknown to him at the time he was representing this defendant.
Yes, I'm more aware of it because I'm also handling the post-conviction, so I'm more aware of it through that. But yes, I agree with that. This was ongoing at the time of this trial.
Right.
And again, I look to the record because some people are able to compartmentalize better than others. And if you're undergoing stress, some people, they immerse themselves in their work. And what's interesting here, I brought up the key testimony of Dr. Makroff. And I know that the length of a cross-examination isn't always indicative of excellent lawyering, but here I think it is, because the cross-examination of her by Bennett lasted a very long time. We know it spreads over 100 pages of the transcript, but there's a point about halfway through where the panel asks Mr. Bennett, "Are you finished yet?" And he goes, "No, I have a few more hours to go." And so then he proceeds, and his cross-examination confronted Dr. Makroff with a whole series of literature about accidental falls. I mean, he really did an excellent job of cross-examining her and Dr. Stevens, and his knowledge, his medical knowledge, did show through. And so, and right from the beginning, I think it's in opening statement, the prosecutor is within a paragraph of the opening statement, and he's launching an objection. So he objected many times throughout and provided a very vigorous defense. And his decision to waive the jury, he put it in terms, this was not a fly-by-night decision, but it's in the record that he talked it over with his counsel, or with Mr. Hunter extensively, with Mr. Hunter's family extensively, and they decided to waive the jury. And then in closing argument, he starts out by telling the panel, you know, everyone's wondering why I represented this case, because of the emotions involved with a child who had been tortured and abused and ultimately killed at the hands of Mr. Hunter. No one knows. That's why I waived the jury, because of the emotion, because you judges could see through it. So when he's talking to the panel. So I think he provided a pretty good glimpse as to why he waived a jury, and I would submit it was in the realm of sound professional practice in this case. And in this case, this court's been confronted with at least 5-6 instances. I cited them in my brief where the lawyers did waive a jury in the case and tried it to a 3-judge panel. And again, I don't know, it's kind of insulting that a 3-judge panel can't be fair and impartial either. I mean, there's no statistical evidence that would suggest that a 3-judge panel can't be fair and impartial, just like a jury. In fact, they might be more fair and impartial because judges hopefully can set aside some of the emotion and judge a case solely on the law and the facts. And you know, that's certainly was what Mr. Hunter thought here.
Counsel, let me address one aspect of the evaluation that opposing counsel made, and that was that whenever you're making a decision to waive a jury, knowing that it only takes one juror to thwart a death penalty here, as opposed to a 3-judge panel, that you do the math, that there's a percentage calculation that you bring into the decision making to determine whether or not that should be done. Is that your experience?
No, my experience would be more, it's probably more emotional. I don't know, when we talk about math, we talk about numbers. It seems to me that those are kind of cold, rigid kind of, you know, we kind of in law look more towards reason, I think. We don't have mathematical formulas that are going to be able to predict our outcomes. So I think you have to go by experience, probably. And you have to look at the death of a young child. What's my defense going to be? Is it going to be more of a legal defense where the 3-judge panel's more apt to side with me? You know, and I'm sure Mr. Bennett, part of the calculation, this was not numbers, but the fact that you had a dead child, that this wasn't just a murder of a child who's 3 years old. This was a torture of a child that's 3 years old. I mean, the emotion that would it be involved in a case like this, I can certainly understand in certain fact patterns why lawyers may want to waive juries, because juries, during experience, tells us that juries are a little bit more emotional.
Counsel, there's really two pretty strong arguments advanced by counsel for the defendant. One is that there ought to be somebody at defense counsel table in a death eligible case who has been certified. Our rule doesn't require that, right. But the suggestion is, and they don't say people shouldn't be free to hire whatever lawyer they want, right. But they certainly suggest if you're doing that, there ought to be two lawyers. If the principal lawyer is not certified under the rule, somebody else ought to be there with them because of all of the cases and the nuances on the legal side. Given, let's assume we're all given to understand Mr. Bennett's a very skilled defense lawyer who is very persuasive in front of courts and juries. He's an imposing figure, and he's knowledgeable and he's articulate and all of those things, but he's not certified. And the certification requires that you become familiar with our cases and all of the cases of the federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court. And so their suggestion is that there ought to be a new trial because that wasn't present. Could you address that?
Well, first of all, I would say that the fact that Mr. Bennett was not certified didn't affect this case at all because he did an outstanding job. It's very clear from the record. Second, I guess this court's decisions have never required there to be two lawyers that have been certified in death penalty cases. So at the time that this case was tried, we were operating within the law. And in the future, if somebody decides that we do have to have certification for counsel, I can't say that I would be opposed to that in the death penalty cases. To me, the more training, the better, that's fine. But just because you have to be certified in death penalty cases, that doesn't mean you're not going to provide somebody a good defense if you are representing
the death penalty. Do we
know if
Bennett had tried other death-eligible cases?
I do not believe he has. I'm not aware of any. If he did, he won acquittals or they're not death penalty, because I'm pretty familiar with the ones we have in our office. So that could have happened.
Mr. Springman, is it a highly unusual situation to have a single attorney who is not certified handling a death penalty case for the defense?
In my experience, it is. I remember the last case that I had before this court, a death penalty case, it was Patrick Leonard, and the lawyers there were two of them, and they were privately retained. But
one of them was certified?
One was certified.
So we have
case.
Two things here. It was a single attorney, and he was not certified under Rule 20.
That is correct in this case. That is correct.
If I understood Mr. Hust's position correctly, he was arguing about the admissibility of other act evidence that was admitted in this trial.
Yes.
And you hadn't addressed the specific evidence that was offered or provided an explanation, presumably under the other act statute,
yes,
as to the reasons for its admissibility. Would you care to comment on that?
Oh, I'd love to. Yes. First of all, I thought in his brief that he admitted that the trial or the panel made the correct decision and that he was raising an issue to preserve it for federal review. But I did address it, and I would address it. There's two, you know. The main defense that was raised was that this was an accidental fall down the stairs.
Right.
So the other act evidence was admitted under the 404B exception to show an absence of mistake or accident, and it fits squarely within that exception. I think I cited a series of two, three, maybe four cases that involved child abuse. I think they were felonious assaults. One might have been an attempted murder or murder, but those were cases that involved child abuse, and other acts were admitted for the purposes of showing an absence of accident, that this was not an accident.
The other acts were also,
and they were other
trips,
bruises, not necessarily trips. One was bruises. One was hitting a stepchild. So very similar circumstances. There's also another reason these other acts were admitted, and I think a very strong reason is that they did form the background of this offense, because what happened, the first other acts was on January 30th of 2004. Trustin was presented to the emergency room of Children's Hospital because he couldn't bear weight on his left leg, and it was determined that his left leg was broken at that time. For some reason, they did not report that incident to the Mayor Center, the Child Advocacy Center, and it wasn't reported to police. Well, 6 months later, in June 9th of 2004, Trustin's again in the emergency room, and Dr. Makroff, of all people, sees him. And this time, it's even worse. Now, the first time, he was in the care of Mr. Hunter, and Mr. Hunter said he was getting a juice cup for Trustin, and he was carrying him up the steps when Hunter says he fell on the steps
and tripped.
And that's how Trustin was injured. Then later, the June 2004 incident is really sad, because when they get to the hospital, he's got some bruising to the ears, which had to have been child abuse, according to the doctors. He had a place in his head where his hair was missing, and there was some discoloration. Then worse than that, they had they found an injury to his penis at the base that was swollen, and it looked like it was pinched, and he was tortured. So they were highly suspicious of child abuse, so they sent Trustin for a series of x-rays called a skeletal survey. And then they found two broken bones in his feet, and one of them was a healing fracture, so it was an old wound. And then they found two broken bones in his hand. One was a new wound, acute, and the other was old. So then, you know, again, this occurred while he was in the care of the defendant. Now, after this June incident, it was decided by Jobs and Family Services that they were going to come up with an action plan for Trustin and remove him and get him away from Lamont Hunter, get him away from his mother, Liz Milda, and they put him with some family members. So it kind of explains his custodial status. Now, for some reason, God only knows why, the record doesn't tell us, some reason he was returned to his birth mother, Liz Milda, and Hunter was living with her, and he was able to have contact with Hunter. Because after the June 04 incident, there was a protective order that prevented Hunter from having any contact with him. So I think those prior injuries are so clearly admissible.
Is that a pattern of misconduct that you're alleging, or absence of mistake?
I think there's two bases for admitting that testimony. One is absence of accident and mistake or accident. That's a separate exception that I think it clearly those other acts fit under. The other is I think it forms the background of the offense under Wilkerson, that those facts are inextricably related to the charged crime because they explain his custodial status. They give us a background of the injuries that Trustin suffered over the years.
Thank you.
I think there's two strong independent bases for the admissibility of that.
Counsel, there seems to be much made about the fact that there was a waiver of the jury trial, or right. The jury in this trial and the three-judge panel. I have two questions. One, there's a suggestion that there should have been an extended colloquy between the judge and the defendant to ascertain the fact that he was knowingly waiving a right to a jury trial, even though this is a new request for this court. And secondly, I have another question is, do death penalty certified attorneys ever waive juries and go with a three-judge panel?
Yes, they do. I believe in, well, I cited five cases, and one of those I'm sure that occurred, and I just can't remember. It might have been Fitzpatrick, but I might be wrong. But I know it's one of the cases I had cited for that proposition. Regarding the extended colloquy for a jury waiver, I'm not sure that would be necessary because on the record, it's somewhere around page 91 in this case, there was a fairly extensive colloquy, but what was put on the record was Mr. Bennett telling the court the issue of waiving the jury in this case has been discussed at length with this defense counsel and Mr. Hunter, my client. This is not the first day or the first time that this issue has been brought to his attention. We have discussed this in detail for a week. This is not a fly-by-night decision. It's well thought out and something we thought about as a defendant and counsel. The court says sure, and then the court turns to Mr. Hunter and he affirms that this all took place. To me, that's enough. If you have the defense counsel telling the court that we talked about this jury waiver, we talked about it at length, and as long as the defendant acknowledges that what counsel says is true, that it was a difficult decision, that it was a lengthy decision, that it was discussed in depth, and then if the court then turns to the defendant and says, do you want to do this? And the defendant makes some acknowledgement on the record, to me, that would be sufficient to waive a jury. More than sufficient. And here I think is a good case that demonstrates that, you know, this was not a fly-by-night decision. This decision was made over some time, several weeks in fact, according to the record.
Mr. Springman, the switch in lawyers occurred just as this case was about to begin trial, is that
right. Correct?
And there's an indication that the public defenders who were previously representing this defendant had secured the services of a mitigation expert. Do we know, had she done all of her work and then just left the field? And if she had, could she not have and should she not have been called by his new private attorney?
It's difficult for me to, I don't know how far along the process that had gone. The record doesn't tell us here. Whether or not, I think it was a she, I think there was a name, Ms. Phillips, as I recall, was in the record. There could be a whole number of speculative reasons why Mr. Bennett decided not to call her. One could have been just simply that she couldn't lend any further support to what the family members were going to say, because his mitigation strategy was pretty effective, because you have mom and dad, but then you have one of his biological daughters, but then you have a non-biological daughter who thought well enough of him and her relationship with him to come into court and give mitigation testimony. I thought that was probably fairly powerful as far as mitigation is concerned in this case. So I'm not sure what a mitigation specialist could add. Plus, as Mr. Freeman noted to the court, he is highly intelligent. So where are you going to score points there? There was no suggestion that he was incompetent or raised a not guilty by reason of insanity plea. So you put the mitigation specialists on, and they're going to have some expertise, and all of a sudden the prosecutor's going to get up there and start cross-examining this mitigation specialist and saying, well, he knew full well what he was doing, didn't he? Yes, he did. There's no suggestion that he's incompetent or suffers from any mental illness. Is there? Oh, no, not at all. So you could see where that could backfire. So maybe he just made that strategic choice under the facts of this case not to call that mitigation specialist.
Do we see today mitigation specialists in almost every death-eligible case?
Not in every case, but they're certainly consulted, and then if they have value in their testimony, then they're certainly, I think, defense counsel.
Their work may be behind the scenes in terms of suggesting to the defense attorney, here are the strongest points and they're the strongest witnesses that you could call, rather than testifying themselves. Is that the case?
Right, I'm sure it goes on all the time, and that's what's troubling when we get to this stage, is we don't know that behind the scenes stuff that was taking place. So I could see in this case very easily what we have, why you wouldn't want the mitigation specialist, because that cross-examination may not have gone so well, you know, in this case. Unless the court has any other questions.
One question. Didn't Mr. Hunter have a drug addiction, or was he in recovery from that substance abuse issue?
The only reference, Your Honor, to any kind of prior drug use came from the father, and there was some cross-examination about a prior conviction that Mr. Hunter had for drug usage, but there wasn't any indication that he was, that solid evidence that he was a drug user.
And with regard to the penalty phase, Mr. Hunter maintained his innocence when he made a statement to the court?
Yes. I apologize, because I remember reading it, and I can't remember if he refused to give a statement, had his counsel read it. I think that's what happened, is he had his counsel read the statement, and I think he did maintain it.
But he didn't really offer his own mitigation any kind of background or being under the influence or anything like that.
No, and he didn't say anything at sentencing either. He just was kind of very quiet throughout the whole proceedings, is my understanding. Yeah, I believe his counsel read his mitigation statement, as I recall it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Freeman, you've used in excess of your time. I'll give you a minute to sum up.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll try and be brief. That's always hard for lawyers, but I'll work extra hard at it. What I hear from Mr. Springman, God bless him, is maybe this, maybe that. This might have happened. Your Honors, this man is on trial for his life. The state is going to execute him unless and until this court is going to be assured that he got a fair trial, both at the merits phase and at the mitigation phase. Here's what I think happened. I think Mr. Hunter was represented by a lawyer who was distracted by a major federal problem that was undisclosed to anybody, because, of course, a plea to an indictment by information is a secret matter. It didn't come out until 6 days after the client was sentenced to death.
I'd like to jump to another matter, because we've heard this already.
Yes, sir.
Because we have to do an independent review of the sentence. What in this case is mitigating?
Judge, we're never going to exactly know. There are the seven family members that came forward and said that Mr. Hunter was good with other children, he was a kind person, that he treated his family well. What we know, we don't know, because the mitigation specialist was never re-engaged or a substitute was never brought forward to get things like Mr. Hunter's school records when he was a kid, his medical records from when he was a kid, any psychiatric records when he was a kid, any drug abuse records from when he was in federal prison for possession of drugs for several years.
Maybe those weren't mitigating.
Well, maybe they weren't, but maybe they were.
Well, if they were, it's not in the record, though, but we don't know. Is that right? That's at this stage of the game.
Conceitedly, you're right, Your Honor. I just think that in an abundance of caution, when an area has not been explored, we have to assume that there's a strong possibility that there could have been things in there that would be extremely exculpatory.
Do we know that it wasn't explored?
Pardon me?
Do we know from the record that it wasn't explored?
Well, no, we don't for sure, Your Honor.
Not at this stage. We don't know that it...
But we do know that the trial lawyer in this case had 4 months from the time he was retained until this trial started.
And nobody did anything, the lawyers that represented before didn't do any work in advance?
They were off the case. They were fired, basically.
But didn't they do any work in preparation?
Certainly.
And wouldn't that have gone to Mr. Bennett?
Sure. They filed pretrial motions, a battery of motions, and those would be beneficial to the client and were incorporated by Mr. Bennett. Their time was not totally wasted, but that still leaves the entire field of mitigation with experts now. It leaves open also the field of experts as to rebuttal of the medical testimony from the two doctors for the state of Ohio. What I think happened was Mr. Hunter basically was confronted by a lawyer who said, for $8,000, I've got the time to try this case, but only with a waiver to a jury. I think that's what happened.
Counsel, with respect to the drug issue, did any family member testify that they had reason to believe that he was an addict?
No, Your Honor.
Or was the testimony just that they knew of a conviction for dealing?
There was a low-level conviction for drug dealing. My client did serve 3 years in federal prison for that. Under the guidelines, the guidelines, frankly, are quite stiffer in federal court than they are in state court. But no, as you know, most low-level dealers are users. Yeah. They deal to feed their own habit.
In the mitigation phase, as far as you know, no family member said he seemed to have an addiction problem.
Your recollection is accurate, Your Honor.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.